This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to the Osher Mini Medical School. I'm Eric Meinberg from the Department of Orthopedic Surgery. My colleague, Paul Toogood, is here this evening. Also, unfortunately, our moderator for the evening, Trig McClellan, wasn't able to make it, so I'll fill in with that. We are all members of the Orthopedic Trauma Institute at the new Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, which opened last week, so far very successfully. We made that transition. I was actually on call this last weekend, and things went very well there, so which is great for a new hospital. But we are members of the Orthopedic Trauma Institute there. We are one of the largest orthopedic trauma groups in the country with 13 surgeons. And we are really proud to be here tonight. To say a couple of words about Paul, he just joined our group. He's an assistant professor here in orthopedic surgery, is double fellowship trained both in orthopedic trauma surgery as well as joint replacement. I'm also an orthopedic trauma surgeon and serve as the director of the arthroplasty service at San Francisco General as well as the faculty here and CPMC. So our first topic this evening, I'll be presenting to you, called Prepare Your Bones, Managing Osteoporosis and Its Complications. So first off, I want to mention this is more of a surgeon's perspective to things and a brief overview. There certainly is a lot to talk and discuss, and certainly there are a lot of the devils in the details as far as some of the medical management of some of these issues, but certainly going to try to touch some of the salient points tonight. So first we're going to talk about is what is osteoporosis and why it's important. The diagnosis and management basics for everyone to understand. And then I think to address a couple of topics, one is whether or not there's a problem with bisphosphonates. There certainly has been a lot of press about this in the past few years with atypical femur fractures and other problems, and also talk about a couple of new treatment paradigms that we have here at UCSF, time permitting. So very briefly, osteoporosis is low bone mass with deterioration of the microarchitecture. And if you see these cross-sections of these vertebrae, these spine bones, you can see a massive difference. It's pretty clear-cut from the back of the room. So on the left side, we have a young, healthy person with normal bone quality, and you see osteoporotic bone on the right. And basically, you just have a complete thinning of the structure. And it's good to take a step backwards. I didn't realize that we'll have a biochemistry lecture as part of this, but to understand osteoporosis as well as to understand the medications and the management of it, I think it's useful to know sort of how your bones function and work. Bones are dynamic living tissue, just like our hearts and livers and lungs and everything else, and they are continuously undergoing turnover. And we have three basic types of cells that that are functioning regularly in our bone. We have the osteoblasts, which are bones that live in and maintain inside the bony framework of the bone. And on the surface of the bone, as well as on the microsurface of it, we also have two other cells. We have cells that predominantly reabsorb bone, called osteoclasts. And you can see these things are just kind of chomping along the surface. And actually, these little feet, can you actually see them on scanning electron microscope, create these very acidic environments. And effectively, what it does is it dissolves the calcium and the stroma that is there. So these are very damaging but very important for normal bone function, as well as remodeling after fractures and things like that. And then we have the bone formation cells called osteoblasts, and these basically work on the surface of the bone and work to build up new bone tissue. And normally we have a balance of these two. There's continuous remodeling going on to provide calcium and other key nutrients in our bloodstream. And there's always a balance between these. By the way, osteocytes are actually osteoblasts that get trapped into the bone, and they just park it and stay there. So in a normal, healthy person, we have a normal balance between what the osteoclasts take and what the osteoblasts create. when we have various forms of bone loss, we can have a couple of forms of this, both which can result in osteoporosis. So we can basically have osteoclasts basically chomping away and outperforming the osteoblasts. And so as a result, you get a net deficit and a net loss of bone. This is what happens to all of us over about the age of 30. You can also get into some specific disease states where you have normal osteoclasts, but the osteoblasts just aren't doing their thing, and they're just not able to keep up with normal production. And that's really not typical or not what we're talking about tonight. But when we look at bone, we can see a massive difference between a younger person and an older person. Unfortunately, these images got thrown off a little bit, it appears, in this translation of this computer. But you see, still looking at the pelvic ring, I was trying to get the hips as well, but you see just sort of the density of the bone, both within the spine, around the pelvis itself, and especially in the hips. You can just make it out here, but there's some very nice, thick bone quality right through here that actually supports the supports your hips like the arch to like a Roman arch or a bridge. But when we have osteoporotic bone, we lose a lot of that architecture. We also lose a lot of the structure within the bone, which makes it very weak. And that's why people, as they get older, are especially susceptible to hip fractures because of the structural weakening through this area. So why is this important? We notice that it happens to all of us beginning at age 30, but it's important to understand the implications of it, both on a public as well as on a personal level. So there are over 1.5 million fractures due to osteoporosis a year just in the U.S. 90% of women over the age of 75 and half over age 50 have osteoporosis. There are over 300,000 hospitalizations per year. And this is a really big deal because people don't do well with osteoporotic fractures. 25% of people do not survive within 1 year after getting a hip fracture. Certainly a lot of people, that is at the very end of their life, and there's a lot of other circumstances around that. 25% require nursing home patients. And this, I think, is what's really critical. Over half of patients greater than age 65 lose independence by at least one degree, which means that if you're walking and fully functional before a hip fracture, then you go to a cane. If you're walking with a cane before your hip fracture, you go to a walker. And unfortunately, if you start with a walker, have a hip fracture, the literature says that what you expect is actually to be in a wheelchair after that. And so that certainly is very dire circumstances, even with our state-of-the-art treatment. Add to that the fact that we have the baby boom generation. We have the oldest baby boomers are already reaching age 65 at this point. The slide's a few years old. And the age of the younger people. And if you look at the normal distribution of fractures by age and how common these occur, by the time people reach age 85, there's a very high rate of hip and vertebral fractures, both which are very significant and have a huge impact on people's lives. And when we have this tidal wave of baby boomers getting older, you can see that within 15 years from now that we are going to be right in the thick of this very significant epidemic of hip and vertebral fractures. So we really need to address this aggressively as a system. Osteoporotic fractures pose a lifetime risk of death that is comparable to breast cancer, which I think is something that people don't fully understand. And it's also it's a precursor and a harbinger for future fractures. And so one of the things that I recommend that you take home tonight is really that if you note that you have a wrist fracture or a foot fracture or some very mild injury that occurs relatively easily, this is the time, if you haven't initiated treatment, to initiate treatment at that point. Because if you can prevent the second fracture from happening, from a fragility fracture, you can potentially reverse the course or slow the course of osteoporosis. As you can see, within 2 years, 20% of people have a second fracture, which is very high. Common sites most commonly are vertebral compression fractures, up to about 50% roughly. Hip fractures, like I said, very high mortality and very significant. And I think what we all have in our mind when we think of these is about 20%. And wrist fractures make up approximately another 15 to 20% as well. And on the personal level, certainly you want to, you know, everyone wants to be at this level, to be out hiking and enjoying life and enjoying time with friends and family, and certainly not working very hard to get by and to get down the street. And so this is where it becomes incredibly important. So let's move on to the diagnosis of osteoporosis. As I mentioned, a fracture itself, fragility fracture, is part of the diagnosis of osteoporosis. But the most common test that we order and we get is called a DEXA scan. And it really is currently the standard for assessing bone mineral density. There are two scores when you get a DEXA scan, and I'll show you through this very quickly, that are important to note. The T score, which is what all of us in the room over about the age 25 will be compared to. And what that does is that compares our bone density compared to our peak bone mass, which is a normal, healthy 25-year-old. The Z score is another number that's tested. And this is really only for people that are on the upward trend when they're still building bone. And because of medications or other developmental issues, that they have poor bone quality. And it compares your density to peers your same age. So you might have the best bones in the 75-plus age group, but that doesn't do you a whole lot of good because we need to have as close to 25- to 30-year-old bone as possible. So always look at the T-score when looking at these. Testing is generally recommended for all men over the age of 70, women over the age of 65, or even less than 65 if there's risk factors, which we'll get into. Anybody that's had a fragility fracture, which is a fracture that occurs from a lower energy mechanism than is expected, such as a fall from a standing height. If you fall and break your wrist from standing or fall and break your hip from standing, that's considered a fragility fracture. And also people that take different medications or dialysis patients, for example, that are at very high risk of losing bone, even if they're a much younger age. This is a typical DEXA scanner. Basically, it's a very low energy radiation through this, scans your body very quickly. It's considered diagnostic, incredibly low radiation compared to even a chest x-ray, which is sort of our benchmark for low radiation. It's painless, it's not confining like an MRI machine is, for those of you who've had that, and you get to stay dressed during this, so don't even have to wear paper shorts or backless nightie or anything like that. There are some issues, though, regarding the cost of it and, more importantly, who pays for it and whether they can be done as an inpatient or outpatient. And that's something that is really being worked out, I think, with insurance. It used to be very easy to get them a few years ago, and insurance payments have scaled way back on this, which is very unfortunate in being able to effectively diagnose people quickly. This is the typical printout that you get from a DEXA scanner, and usually what's looked at is the vertebra, the hips, and either the wrist or the heel as a third site. And then from that, you will get a report that shows the bone density, sort of where this person fits between being in the green zone, which is healthy bone, the blue zone, which is osteopenic on the way to osteoporosis, and then getting down into more and more severe osteoporosis. And then again, you can see here, I can't see it because I have my glasses on, but the T score is right here and the Z score is right there. So this person is about minus 1.7, 1.9, which is osteopenic. Remember, osteoporosis is 2 or less below the age group. But this is the typical report that you would go over with your doctor after getting a test like this. Again, as we mentioned, if you're minus 1 to minus 2.4, you're osteopenic, which is a mild to moderate bone deficiency, and if you're greater than 2.5 standard deviations below normal, then you're considered osteoporotic. And again, if a fragility fracture has occurred, you have osteoporosis regardless of the bone density score. There are a number of blood tests that we also get to follow up the DEXA scan to mark and to also help understand the cause of osteoporosis. So we get some basically bone is built off of, we know it's calcium, but it's built off of a cartilage or a collagen matrix or framework. And so you can actually pick these up in the urine. If bone is being degraded, you'll get these different telepeptides, which are products of the collagen breakdown, as well as evidence of bone formation, such as serum alkaline phosphatase or ELK-phos, which is very bone-specific. Osteocalcin and P1NP are all different tests that can be done to actually just look at the metabolic turnover of your bone and whether that's being created or being lost. As I mentioned before, there's some specific risk factors aside from age and bone mass, certainly a low body weight. Estrogen tends to have a protective effect on your bone. And fat creates low-level estrogen. So actually, heavier people do better in this and generally have a better bone quality. There's also a stress response to carrying more weight around that you tend to have slightly better bones. Certainly being overweight versus underweight in itself doesn't significantly put you at, you know, impossible to have or impending fractures. Smoking certainly has a very high rate of this. Corticosteroid also has a strong risk factor for loss of bone mass for numerous reasons. High alcohol intake and then specific drugs can cause bone loss, as well as inflammatory autoimmune disorders such as rheumatoid arthritis and lupus arthritis. Drugs that are really bad and are really heavily associated with osteoporosis include steroids, use of heparin, a lot of seizure medications such as Dilantin cause osteoporosis because of the metal analogs to calcium that are with them, the old antibiotic tetracycline, which is very rarely used these days, Lasix is a common one, and then a couple of medications. Aromatase inhibitors are used for some forms of breast cancer, gynecomastia, as well as Lupron, which inhibits the sexual hormones. Both of those do. Steroid-induced osteoporosis is especially difficult to deal with and on multiple levels. So steroids do a number of things with our bone metabolism, including blocking absorption of calcium that we take in and eat, increasing the output through the urine, so we are not taking enough calcium in, we're dumping more calcium out, we're blocking the formation of collagen, increasing bone resorption by those osteoclasts, and we're also changing the architecture in the bone in a way that other forms of osteoporosis don't, by actually forming these very little spindles, which are even worse than the typical standard form. As I mentioned before, men are not immune to osteoporosis. It's not as common, but it still can happen. Still, there's about a 25% risk, lifetime risk. One-third of all hip fractures do occur in men. And unfortunately, there's actually a higher mortality rate among men that get a hip fracture than there are among women. And in part, it's probably because of an increased age, but when men do have poor enough bone quality to get these fractures. But they are very similar risk factors in general, family history, smaller frame, use of medication, smoking, and also low testosterone can be associated with a higher risk. So let's talk about treatment. One of the first things to do is to avoid all the good stuff such as tobacco, alcohol, exercise a lot, and a fall prevention program to increase stability is important. So Don Draper and the madman lifestyle is out as far as bone health. In general, we recommend for most patients, and certainly check with your primary care physician about this, is 1,200 milligrams a day of calcium in a combination with vitamin D. You can see that calcium supplementation is incredibly important. A glass of milk is only going to get you about a quarter of the way there, as is a yogurt. So you have to be chowing down on a lot of dairy to be able to match our standard intake, let alone if you're in a deficit mode and need to build up from them. Supplements offer about 600 milligrams per dose, so you need to take them quite regularly. There's a limit to what you can take with Oscal or Tums, which is the easy, cheap form of it, because you need stomach acid to be able to absorb it. Similarly, if you're taking any sort of medications for gastric reflux, any acid reducers, that will reduce your ability to absorb this type of calcium. Citracal doesn't require the stomach acid and can be taken at a higher dose at one time safely. There's been a lot of interest recently in vitamin D supplementation. Most people, certainly the slide says a majority of older adults have insufficient or deficient vitamin D. I would go so far as to say most of us do. Even in the trauma population, 20, 30-year-olds, we see a lot of patients that have a problem healing fractures actually are vitamin D deficient even at a young age. Part of it is sunlight exposure, part of it's dietary, part of it's just the fact we're wearing sunblock and clothing and things like that that would normally normally are actually blocking the conversion of vitamin D in our skin. So In the workup of this, we like to obtain vitamin D levels to guide replacement, and we do need to get vitamin D up to a baseline level before starting calcium supplementation as well as bisphosphonate therapy, because we need to make sure that we have the building blocks in place to be able to do that. There's also added benefit of vitamin D, which helps with muscle strength, and with that helps clinically reduce falls in people that are taking it. So this slide is in the slide deck that's provided to you, and there's a number of different recommendations. So as you can see, the vitamin D supplementation can be increased significantly. Certainly if people have an incredibly low vitamin D level, and we do see this quite frequently in our fracture practices, especially if we see people that have problems healing their fractures, we really need to juice them up with a tremendous amount of vitamin D2. And as you can see, as we go up to normal levels, then we reduce that dose. So let's start talking about some of the medical therapies besides this. Bisphosphonates is, by and large, the most commonly used, most well-known medications. These are medications such as Fosamax that have been on the market for a long time. Certainly, if you don't take it, you probably know people that have, or you did take it at one point in the past. And basically what these drugs do is they kill osteoclasts. They turn them off and shut them down so the osteoblasts, the cells that are making the bones, can kind of chug along and do their thing without having their work being undone. It does a couple of other things, but basically has what it does is it kills the cells, and it also disrupts that ruffled border, those little feet that create the acidification to dissolve the bone. There are some side effects, which we'll get into. Osteonecrosis of the jaw is a severe one, but extraordinarily rare. But atypical subtrochanteric fractures can occur and can be relatively common. So again, you have an osteoclast here. The bisphosphonates are the little yellow beads that are being sucked up, and it basically decreases the function of them and causes apoptosis or cell death, which allows the cells to continue on their own. The next that we'll talk about is denosumab, which is a medication called Provia or Zajeva. It is what's called a rankle antibody, and this is can be a difficult term, but it'll make sense when we take a look at the cartoon that goes over it. And these temporarily prevent osteoclast formation and function, so it doesn't kill them, it kind of stuns them. And this is useful because it decreases fracture risk, decreases the complications of fractures significantly, and decreases healing time. So this can be very useful in people that have had fragility fractures that we need to increase their healing response. And as you can see here, these little purple marks basically blocks the cells that act as messengers to turn on the osteoclasts. So what it's doing is the osteoclasts are just not getting the signal to go to work and going around and not able to purely function, but that also can be turned off, and there certainly are some advantages for that. The next one is a medication called teriparatide, which is also a parathyroid hormone, which is recombinant, but is formed naturally in our body as a normal hormone. And it has been found that intermittent low-dose parathyroid hormone is anabolic or builds up bone. It's indicated for extreme osteoporosis with a T-score less than 3. It can only be used for up to 2 years. And it's really thought to boost up the osteoblasts. So rather than killing or stunning the osteoclasts or chewing up the bone, what it's doing is supercharging the osteoblasts to build up more bone. It certainly has some risk factors associated with it. There is a mild concern about there being a carcinogenic factor with this, again, because it's anabolic, but also very rare. But it is generally contraindicated in Paget's disease, which is a high turnover bone disease that can actually has a very low risk of turning to cancer. Shouldn't be used in children and people that have had prior radiation, again, because of that increased cancer risk. So let's talk briefly about bisphosphonate-related femur fractures. So as I mentioned, medications, the most common medication that we are used to is Fosamax, which was introduced in the 1990s. and they were really heralded as something as a significant improvement and a significant tool in the treatment of osteoporosis. It caused a significant decrease in vertebral compression fractures and osteoporosis-related hip fractures. And in 2008, there were 31 million people were using it, and that has decreased because of these fractures that have occurred and some knowledge about it, as well as new medications that have come on board, to about half of that in 2012. And what we started seeing about 10 years after its introduction were these atypical fractures that were basically stress fractures in the hip. And this was all caused by minimal trauma, and it created this very telltale fracture, which was a subtrochanteric fracture, so a fracture between the hip and the shaft of the femur right in this area. And you could see this very common pattern where the bone got very thick and kind of formed like a little taffy-pulled beak right in there. And the bone became, despite the fact it was much thicker and very solid, it became very brittle. And, people would state just getting up out of their car or the bus stopping or twisting to get in and out, of getting dressed or something like that would actually break their hip. The first report in 2005 was a group of 9 women that were treated for an average of about 5 years. And subsequently, there's a lot of newer research that shows that the risk is incredibly low, but goes up with the amount of time that you use bisphosphonate. So 2 years of bisphosphonate use, the rate is extraordinarily low, 2 in 100,000 people. After 8 years of use, you can see it goes up significantly. But it is important to remember that despite these numbers, which sound very scary, that the risk of a typical hip fracture for people not treated is actually over 1,000 in 100,000, so 10% of people are at risk of a hip fracture. And when you institute this treatment, that goes down by half. So even if you add in patients that have been on bisphosphonate for a very long time, we are still roughly half of its natural history. So these, I can't stress enough that these are still very important, very useful drugs to use.
That's only
1%. Excuse me?
I think you said 10%.
Oh, 10%, 1%, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Huge.
And the mechanism behind this is actually thought to just increase the stiffness of the collagen, so the bone gets stiffer. And again, these osteoclasts are stunned and killed, and so they're not able to create a balance of taking away old bone and building new bone. So you're just piling up new bone that becomes very thick and very stiff. And the subtrochanteric area of the femur is a very high stress area because it's right below that Roman arch of the hip that we create. And really, it creates just like a stress fracture. Here's a impending fracture that we see in a hip in a person that comes in with hip pain, and here's a stress fracture in the tibia in a long-distance young runner, and it's effectively the exact same thing. And because of the shape of the bone, as I mentioned, it makes it very, very high likelihood of happening. And in older people especially, there's a triple whammy because there's poor bone quality compared to younger patients. There's an exacerbation of deforming forces because as we get older, this bow tends to tip and get a little bit more than when we're younger. And then because of the bisphosphonates and because that coupled degradation and growth of the bone that goes together, even when we heal fractures, the healing is a lot slower. And so ultimately what happens is you get a fracture like this, and ultimately then we treat it most successfully with a rod similar to this. It allows people to do very well. It's done through very small poke hole incisions. Paul will probably be talking about this very soon. And it allows for early weight bearing. Typically, we let people walk on this immediately. Even though the hip will hurt while you're walking, it's actually safe to do. We also recommend certain very close evaluation of the other hip. And in some circumstances, we discuss with the patients, and we'll even put these rods in if we see what we call an impending fracture, or if we see the line and we see that beaking and things on the other side, to just avoid the future injury and the future pain and fracture with X. It's a very easy surgery to do. Certainly, you don't want to just go out and get nails in your hips, but it's something that can be done. So as a result of all of this concern, and this is something that still is just coming out. So this was out of a paper. Joe Lane is an expert at Hospital for Special Surgery in Manhattan, just put out this recommendation earlier this year. We're still seeing this figured out, and you still see a lot of different opinions about it. But in general, if you have a fracture, stop using bisphosphonates, whether that's a distal radius fracture, a hip fracture, or a vertebral compression fracture. What's now being recommended is that after about 3 to 5 years, it's thought that the maximum benefit of these medications has taken effect. The half-life of the medication is incredibly long. So what we say is a therapeutic pause, or stop taking it after about 3 to 5 years of use. And this is recommended in people that are low risk, that haven't had a fracture, or people that have had a recent fracture, like we said. If you had a fracture, please stop it. But there is a group of people that should continue to use it. As you mentioned, glucocorticoids or steroids like prednisone and medications like that, if you're taking that in regular use or some specific high turnover diseases, you should continue to use this because you need the maximum benefit from the steroids. So very briefly, I want to give Paul certainly his time to talk and then time to answer a lot of questions at the end. I want to talk about a couple of new concepts in the management. We talked a lot about the medical management. Paul's going to be talking about the surgical management. But I think what's really important is a couple of the systems management issues to do a better job and manage this, which we are instituting here at UCSF and San Francisco General. And you're seeing at some places around the country, and certainly we'll be hearing a lot more of. And one of the ideas behind this is co-managed care, which is a new way really to treat patients. As medical outsiders, it probably makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't quite work this way in practice. So the basic principles of a shared practice for managing hip fractures and osteoporosis in the hospital is that most patients benefit from surgical stabilization of the fracture, so everyone needs surgery, and it's been shown that the faster the people get surgery, the less time they have to get sick in the hospital, and ultimately the better they do. So the quickest you can get in the hospital, through surgery, and out of the hospital, the better it is rather than sitting around waiting for surgery or getting a lot of tests. Co-management, so that basically means being managed both by the surgeon as well as an internal medicine specialist with frequent communication, avoids any sort of complications or missteps. Typically, in most hospitals, people are either admitted to internal medicine and the surgeons stay away, or they go to surgery, and potentially they don't get the degree of internal medicine management that they would if they were being managed by both. So this is where this is incredibly useful. And the other thing is, just like having a fire drill or anything else, having a standardized protocol to decrease any sort of variability or any sort of problems or custom matching to the patient, to be able to do this as effectively as possible is important, as well as an efficient hospital stay. So starting your discharge planning at admission so that you can be on your feet and moving into rehabilitation and moving towards home as soon as you reach the front doors of the hospital, not after you've had surgery and then waiting to make plans afterwards. So a lot of the benefits of this include shared ownership. So people are seen on a daily basis by both services. The teams are talking to each other very well, have equal shared responsibilities, so it's not that one is in charge and the other is secondary to that. And there's pre-worked out arrangements so that this is consistently done the same way, who they're admitted to and everything else. And so it's incredibly important to be able to sort of share that communication and also to prevent any sort of disagreements or discussions or turf battles as far as how these are managed and to be able to get people out the door. There's a lot of advantages to this. It's a very collegial, congenial environment rather than kind of trying to get each other's attention and make sure that we're taking care of ourselves as well as the other person. It's mutually respectful and really provides true interdisciplinary care and coordination. There's a big difference between interdisciplinary care and multidisciplinary care. Anybody that comes to a modern hospital typically gets multidisciplinary care, which basically means all appropriate services take care of the patients, but they're not necessarily working together. Whereas in interdisciplinary care, everybody is in an integrated and collaborative fashion, so things get taken care of better. So this is kind of the worst case example, where you have all these people working in silos, and they're each doing their things. The orthopedic surgeon will fix it. The anesthesiologist will put the person to sleep and wake them up. And the geriatric person will take care of the medical issues associated with it. But no one's really talking together, and no one's working very well. But in an interdisciplinary model, everybody is communicating very closely at every step of the way. And this really is a big change in how we do this and able to coordinate the effects with it. And as a result, we get better processes, better efficiency, better coordination, and ultimately we get better care for the patient. The last thing I'd like to talk about briefly is something that we've started here at UCSF in the last 2 years, which is the Geriatric Orthopedic Fellowship and starting a new specialty. Some of the challenges that we have just as surgeons is managing patients, and patients have older patients have problems with a lot of medical comorbidities, have a limited surgical reserve, so it's incredibly important to act very efficiently and effectively and carefully in a way that is different than, say, with a 20- or 30-year-old trauma patient. We have to deal with poor bone quality in being able to get the pieces back together anatomically so that there's no rotational or length discrepancies or anything like that, good enough fixation to allow for them to heal reliably, and ability to rehabilitate very effectively. It's hard for older people to stay on crutches or stay off of their legs for an extended period of time. So we're going to be able to fix these solidly enough so you can walk immediately without risk of hurting the fracture. A perfect example is pelvic fractures. Older people do far, far worse than younger people with relatively basic fractures, and there's a much, much higher overall mortality. As we can see also that the effects of surgery on pelvis fractures are much, much worse. So young patient, say the 20-some-year-old that's in a motorcycle accident and has a very bad pelvis fracture, has about 87% chance for good to excellent results, which means they don't have pain, they're able to get back to their function they were able to beforehand. But as you see, they get older, and these numbers continue to drop with older age groups. By the time people are 60, 69, you get to slightly better than 50% good and excellent results, and people are doing far, far less well. And so, as we mentioned before, orthopedic surgery in itself is a very siloed system. There's very little interplay and interaction between the subspecialties. So I go to a trauma meeting. We both do arthroplasty, or joint replacement, and trauma. So there's a joint replacement meeting. There's actually a hip meeting and a knee meeting, and hip people talk about hip things. Knee people talk about hip things, or talk about knee things. Fracture people talk about broken bones, and people don't really talk too much as far as what the cutting edge and how to work well. And there's also very little cross-training in advanced surgical techniques. So here at UCSF, we have trauma fellows at San Francisco General that learn all about managing fracture surgery. There are joint replacement fellows here at Parnassus that learn all about hip and knee replacements, but there's very little interflow between those. Similarly, we don't see a lot of interaction between cardiology fellows and pulmonary fellows and renal fellows in internal medicine. But the thing is that advanced knowledge in all of these skills is really important. And we see this in pediatrics, where in adults we have trauma and joint replacement and shoulder and elbow specialists and foot specialists and sports specialists. In children, pediatric orthopedic specialists take care of all of those things. And so it's a very different model. And here are just two different papers that basically look at using, basically one paper is advocating the use of joint replacements for managing fractures involving a joint. Another one is talking about fixing those and using the joint themselves. And you can see that even though this is a patient that I would see, and this was an old patient of mine from years ago that had a really bad elbow fracture that's just absolutely crushed, as well as a knee injury, you can see very poor bone quality, old surgery with some old implants, and really, really terrible injury. As you can see, the bone is absolutely pulverized in here. And in this area right here, you can actually see how bad his bone quality is. That there's actually, normally you'll see this sort of meshy coral pattern throughout here. There's absolutely nothing here except for a big hole. And so very, very poor bone quality. And what we started out doing was we fixed it just like we fix a 30-year-old, and that was able to rebuild the structure of the bone. But ultimately, he required a pretty extensive knee replacement because the joint was damaged so badly. Here's another case where you have a patient that has a hip fracture. One group of people would say to fix it. One group of people would say is put in a partial hip replacement. One group of people would say put in a total hip replacement. And we need to be able to reliably and depending on the person be able to do that all as well as possible. Similar with elbow fractures, that these can be treated in a different way. And so in the traditional method, one person might do the joint replacement and one person might put together the elbow, and it requires two different trips to the OR and two different teams of people from one fall. And we need to be able to do a better job with that. Similarly, you have a person here that is in a motor vehicle accident, and they have this really horrible injury. So they have a bad hip fracture, a fracture of the femoral head, as well as a pelvis and a acetabular or hip socket fracture. And all of these in themselves are very significant injuries, and the combination of them are very difficult to treat. And so you can see that there's pretty significant problems with that. And ultimately, we had to fix this with both an extensive surgery to fix the pelvis as well as a hip replacement at the same time. And to have one person that's able to do that is a huge advantage both in the surgical management as well as efficient patient management for this. And so as I mentioned, in adults, we have this current fellowship structure where we have trauma specialists, joint replacement specialists, foot and ankle specialists, and shoulder and elbow specialists. But we also have some unique issues for older patients, including management of severe osteoporosis and metabolic bone disease, talking about being a specialist in that co-managed model of care, and as well as being a specialist in rehabilitation. And so what we've created is the geriatric fellowship that is a combination of all of these, serving as an umbrella to coordinate this care. So here at UCSF, 2 years ago, we started the fellowship, which is the first of its kind worldwide. We were able to leverage our clinical and research experience here across all subspecialties. We're having our second fellow. We'll be starting with us next year. Second program has actually just started, starting this summer at University of Minnesota, and we're actually working with the Geriatric Fracture Society, which, again, is another specialized group of people, to develop multiple programs and to promote them so that we can count on the next years when we have this tidal wave of osteoporotic fractures, have specialists that can best treat this. Thank you very much. I'd like to introduce Paul Toogood. As I mentioned, Paul was a resident here at UCSF, did a trauma fellowship at Harborview, which is University of Washington in Seattle, and probably one of the preeminent trauma programs in the country. Following that, he was a joint replacement fellow at the Mayo Clinic before returning back with us this year. So, Paul?
All right. Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks, everyone, for coming. So, like Dr. Meinberg said, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, mostly at San Francisco General Hospital. I'm faculty here at UCSF. You may or may not have been aware that if you go to Parnassus or if you go to what is now Zuckerberg, you're going to see a UCSF physician. So I'm one of them down at the Zuck. And I was given, that's the new term for SFGH. And I was given the topic of the broken hip, and this is something that I spent a lot of time training about, number one, because it's common, and number two, because I did a trauma fellowship and an arthroplasty fellowship, and these are both areas of medicine that are interested in this problem. Anyone in here ever have a hip fracture? No? Okay. Anyone know anyone who ever had a hip fracture? Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a common problem, as Dr. Meinberg mentioned. And it's interesting, usually when I give a talk, I give a talk to a group of orthopedic surgeons or residents, and they're really interested in like the nitty-gritty, tiny little details of what we do for a living. So where you put this retractor, or why you use that screw and not this other screw, and things like that. And I had to take a big step back and sort of figure out what the forest was, because I knew you guys weren't going to be interested in the trees. So this is my effort to do that. I don't have any disclosures. I'm not gaining anything from this talk. So this is the outline for the talk. We're going to talk about what a hip fracture is. It's a common term that even I just rattled off, but as it turns out, it's not a term that an orthopedist uses. If I told Dr. Meinberg I had a hip fracture for him, he'd have no idea what I was talking about. And that's not because he doesn't give lectures on hip fractures, it's because it's not a specific term. Why do we fix them? Dr. Meinberg touched on that a little bit, but I'll reemphasize that. How do we fix them? And I'll just go into the basics on that, again, trying not to lose the forest through the trees. How do we choose amongst the tools that I'm going to present to you? And what are the outcomes? And I think you'll be interested to know that they're probably not as good as you might think. So taking a step back, talk a little bit about anatomy, just so everyone gets oriented here. So this is the pelvis, okay? This bone right here is called the sacrum. It's really the bottom of the spine, and it's where the pelvis and the spine come together. And then on either side, these sort of big ears are called the innominate bones, which means a bone that has no name. And so those three bones come together to make the pelvis. And when we talk about hip fractures, there's one particular part of the pelvis that we're interested in, and that's the acetabulum, which is this area right here. And the acetabulum is a cup. That's all it is, just a cup. And then the other bone we have to worry about is the femur. Okay, here's the femur right there, and at the top of the femur, there's a ball. And there are a couple of joints like this in the body, and we very cleverly call these ball and socket joints. Okay, and so this is a very simple diagram of a ball and socket joint, and that's really all we're talking about. And so you might think, okay, well, there must be ball fractures, there must be socket fractures, and this is going to be a pretty short talk. But as it turns out, it's a lot more complicated than that, and there's a reason that orthopedic training takes 6 or 7 years. So this is the proximal femur, and just to go over some anatomy here. So this area here is called the femoral head, okay? It kind of looks like a head, and this is called the femoral neck, okay? A little bit smaller and below the head, so we decided to call it the neck. And then this little bump here is called the greater trochanter, and this little bump right here is called the lesser trochanter. And those little bumps exist because that's where muscles attach or originate from. And then below that is an area called the subtrochanteric region of the femur, which just means below this guy, the lesser trochanter, subtrochanteric. And then off the screen here is the rest of the femur, the femoral shaft. And so when you have a hip fracture, as it turns out, it's very important to us where the break is. Because we classify fractures around the hip. Within about 6 centimeters here, we have a variety of different injuries that we're talking about. So as it turns out, a femoral head fracture is a totally different beast from a femoral neck fracture, which is a totally different beast from an intertrochanteric fracture. And you can see that's about a centimeter or a centimeter and a half difference there, which is a totally different beast from a subtrochanteric fracture. Okay, so a hip fracture is not just a hip fracture. A femur fracture is not just a femur fracture. There's a whole bunch of things within that category. And in fact, orthopedists love to classify and subclassify, and I'm not showing you this to make you memorize it, just to sort of shock and awe you, that within each one of these categories I just told you, there's a bunch of subcategories. So believe it or not, if I told Dr. Meinberg there's a femoral head fracture, he'd still want to know a whole lot more about that. Okay, he want to know, well, is it a Pipkin 1? Is it just the bottom of the head that's broken off? Or is it a Pipkin 2? Is the whole head top to bottom cut through? Is there an associated femoral neck fracture? That's a Pipkin 3. And what if there's an acetabular fracture or a dislocation of the hip along with it? That's a Pipkin 4. And you might think, well, boy, this is a lot of minutiae. I mean, why are we talking about this? Well, as it turns out, these all get treated differently. And the prognoses for all these fractures are very different as well. And we can march on through all these different levels I mentioned, and the same thing continues to be true. So femoral neck fractures are a very common injury, one of the most common injuries amongst the geriatric population in particular, and they also happen in younger individuals. And we spent a lot of time trying to figure these out, and actually they're still sort of a holy grail in orthopedics. We still don't have these completely figured out, despite their being very common. And so we, classify these things to death. So again, if I told Dr. Meinberg, hey, I've got a femoral neck fracture in the emergency department that I'm going to have you treat for me because I'm going to go home and take a nap, again, that wouldn't be enough information for Dr. Meinberg. He'd want to know a lot more because if it's a subtrochanteric fracture, that's very different from a basicervical fracture, okay? If it's an incomplete garden 1, that's very different from a complete garden 4. And if you have a Powell's angle of 30 degrees, that's very different than a Powell's angle of 70 degrees. These all really affect the treatment options that we might suggest to a patient, as do a lot of other things I'm not even mentioning, patient age, bone quality, all these things. Intertroch fractures. So again, the greater troch is this little bump where your abductors insert. The lesser trochanter is this little guy right here where your iliopsoas, your hip flexor, inserts. And so anything in between there is called an intertrochanteric fracture, between the trochanters fracture. And a lot of intertrochanteric fractures are kind of like this. They go in between them. All right, and we call that a normal obliquity or regular obliquity fracture. And it turns out that's way different than if the fracture line is just going in the opposite way. Okay, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but if that fracture takes a 90-degree turn, it's a totally different animal. And subtrochanteric fractures are the same. So again, fractures below the level of the lesser trochanter. We've subclassified these to death as well. There's a gentleman named Russell Taylor that did that and divided these into four groups. So now we've talked about the femur. It turns out it's even worse when you talk about the acetabulum. The acetabulum is very complicated. It's one of the reasons that people like myself and Dr. Meinberg go into trauma surgery, is to learn how to fix these very complex injuries. So I just bored you with all the different subcategorizations of proximal femur fractures. The acetabulum is a whole level of magnitude more difficult to diagnose and treat. These French guys, Jude and Letrunel, classified acetabular fractures back in about the 50s and 60s. Before that, we had no classification system whatsoever, and they divided them up into elementary and associated. As you might imagine, the elementary ones are a little easier than the associated ones, and there's five within each one of these categories. Everything from the surgical approach to the hardware to the risks are totally different for all of these different fracture patterns. So that's all to come to this one point, which is that a hip fracture is not a hip fracture, It's a large group of diagnoses. They all have their own natural history. They all have their own surgical treatments and prognoses. So hip fracture is not really a term that orthopedists use. So that's sort of our long-winded definition of a hip fracture. So now let's go into why we fix these, and Dr. Meinberg touched on this a little bit. So this is the number one reason, is that the mortality rate associated with hip fractures is very high. Now, this number is not accurate, I'll tell you that. This number is very old, okay? And so this number has changed a lot for a lot of reasons. So, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago, not only did we not have good orthopedic treatments, we didn't have a lot of good medical treatments either. And so if you didn't treat a hip fracture today, you just treated it non-operatively, I'm sure you wouldn't find that 85% of people didn't make it 1 month. But that number would still be very high, because even if you treat it, and this is a current number, about 25 or 30% of people are not alive in a year, okay? So the mortality rate associated with hip fractures is actually very high. And in fact, one of the things that I do right away when I'm counseling a patient or their family is to tell them this. Because you can imagine, even though our goal is to get someone up and out of bed and walking the next day, that sounds like a great, very lofty goal, very optimistic. It's important to tell people up front that this is a marker of decline, or at least it can be, and the mortality rate is high. Okay. And the cause of death is not the hip fracture itself per se. It's the immobilization that's caused by it. And so people end up dying of pneumonia or a urinary tract infection that goes into the blood and causes sepsis, bed sores that do the same, or just deconditioning. It turns out if you take even a healthy young person and put them in bed for a week, they've lost a measurable amount of muscle mass just by the end of the week. And you can imagine a 65 or a 75-year-old or an 85-year-old individual who maybe doesn't have a whole lot of muscle mass to lose to begin with, that can be a serious problem. And that's why one of the things we do, just like Dr. Meinberg mentioned, is we try to get these people up and out of bed right away. So that's the real goal of hip fracture surgery. And then the other reason is not just to prolong someone's quantity of life, which of course is the number one goal of medicine in general, but a lot of what we do in orthopedics is to improve their quality of life, especially now. People don't just want to, you know, eke out an existence. They'd like to, you know, continue to do the things that they want to do and enjoy in life. And so it's these seven letters that we're trying to accomplish, which is to get people out of bed, weight bearing is tolerated. So really, the goal is, no matter whether you present with a Garden 3 transcervical femoral neck fracture and you get a total hip, or if you present with a normal obliquity intertrochanteric fracture and you get what's called a sliding hip screw, or if you have an atypical bisphosphonate-related subtrochanteric fracture of the femur and you get what's called a cephalomedullary nail, really, the goal is to take this person and turn them into this person. That's really the goal. Okay. So that's what a hip fracture is, and that's sort of the big, broad picture of why we fix them. And so now I'm going to talk a little bit about how we fix them. And the difficulty with this portion of the talk for me was that this is what I spend most of my time talking about. And I really had to back up a few steps and paint it with broad strokes here. But in general, what we do in orthopedics is we perform internal fixation or we perform an arthroplasty. Okay, so an internal fixation conceptually is where you take the broken pieces, you put them back together in some fashion, and you put a device in that holds those pieces until they heal. In a way, conceptually, it's no different from a cast that maybe some of you had when you were a kid. Just as it turns out, casting is a pretty crude way to hold a lot of fractures in place while they heal, both from a practical standpoint also just the standpoint of trying to accomplish the goal, which is to get a bony union. If we can't perform internal fixation for a number of reasons, we'll do what's called an arthroplasty. And an arthroplasty is we're not trying to get anything to heal. We're trying to get someone up out of bed on an implant that will allow them to do that. So to break this down a little bit more, spend a lot of time on these graphics. So this is a femur, believe it or not. Okay, so this is that femoral head I was talking about. Okay, and this is the femoral neck, that area there. This is a very poor version of the greater trochanter. I skipped the lesser trochanter completely. And this is the shaft of the femur. And so maybe you fall down and you have this problem. Okay, so there's now two broken segments to this bone. So with internal fixation, the first step of the procedure, essentially, is to do this, is to put the bone back where it belongs. Okay, and you know, if you could do this, if we just kept you anesthetized for 6 weeks in this position on the operating table, you would eventually heal this, but most people don't tolerate that, including the surgeons. And so instead what we do next is we put in an implant, okay, and this is a bad version of this sliding hip screw that I showed you before. And the goal of this implant is to not to obtain the reduction, but to maintain the reduction so that it doesn't go away over the course of several weeks. And as it turns out, we try to design implants that not only maintain the reduction initially with you lying on the operating room table, but maintain the reduction when you get up out of bed and walk, hopefully the next day after surgery. We also try to preserve the blood supply when we're doing this, okay, and that actually turns out to be very important for fracture healing and also to reduce your risk of infection. And again, the ultimate goal for internal fixation or an open reduction in internal fixation is fracture healing, okay, because it turns out the implants that we use, if you don't heal, they'll break, actually. So I often tell patients the implants that we use with internal fixation is like a paperclip. So if you take a paperclip and you bend it once, it can tolerate that. But if you bend it back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, the paperclip eventually breaks, okay? And that's what happened here. So this didn't catastrophically fail. It's not like the patient got off the operating room table and suddenly this broke in half. What happened is this femoral neck fracture never healed, okay? And so for maybe 6 months, this poor little screw was getting stepped on and stepped on and stepped on and stepped on, and so it broke, okay? So ultimately, all devices that are meant for internal fixation are temporary. They're not temporary in that we just don't pull them out, because that's more surgery. Usually internal fixation devices are left in place. But their purpose and their lifespan is temporary. It's designed to last 3, 6, 9, 12 months until the body heals the fracture. And that is opposed, these are some examples of internal fixation. So sometimes we use expensive screws, and sometimes we use expensive plates and screws, and sometimes we use expensive nails. And sometimes have to do complex versions of this. And this was one of my very first cases as an attending. This was a 20-year-old something who got into a motorcycle accident and has this acetabular fracture. And so this was about 6 hours of surgery and about a 30-centimeter incision to get this back together. But the goal is the same. Put all the bony pieces back together and have them heal. But next we're going to talk about arthroplasty. So that was internal fixation. Again, the goal of that is to hold things in place till they heal. And arthroplasty is different. So in arthroplasty, you have the same problem. You start off with the same bad graphic of the femoral neck fracturing. The first step in this procedure is we take it out. We give up. We don't think it's going to heal, so we remove the broken piece. And then the next step in the procedure is we put in an implant. And the implant kind of looks like what we took out. And the goal here is not to get anything to heal. We've removed whatever had the potential for healing. The goal is to put an implant in here that's going to last the lifespan of the patient. And it initially has to have some inherent stability, and that's accomplished by the geometry of the implant. But as it turns out, the body also has to grow into this implant as well. So the surfaces of these implants have a coating on them usually that allows the osteoblasts to grow into the implant such that eventually it's actually healed to the bone. And to remove it, you would actually have to chisel it away. And that's what provides long-term implant stability. That takes about 6 weeks. But again, the goal here is not healing. The goal is an implant that lasts the lifespan of the patient. And arthroplasties around the hip come in two flavors. There are hemiarthroplasties, which is half of an arthroplasty, and then there are total hip arthroplasties, which is a complete arthroplasty. So a total hip arthroplasty, there's a pin down the femur, there's a ball, and there's a cup. A hemiarthroplasty, there's just a pin down the femur and a ball. And we don't do anything to your native acetabulum. We actually just leave it. And we don't do half a hip replacement because we have like half as much time or half as much energy that day. We do it because there are different benefits and different risks for these procedures. So this is a more extensive procedure, obviously. There's two components instead of one. This is a less extensive procedure. This is a procedure that is less likely to cause people pain if they're very active because you have a metal ball rubbing on a piece of plastic. This is a procedure that is more likely to cause people pain or discomfort if they're very active because you have a metal ball rubbing on cartilage. But if you're not very active, it's unlikely to cause those symptoms. And this is also less likely to dislocate. Okay, so for more elderly, low-demand people who are at a high risk for dislocation, generally we use a hemiarthroplasty. For people who are relatively high demand and want to get on a bike or go for a long walk, we're more likely to use a total hip arthroplasty. All right, so we're going to go a little more into how do we choose amongst these tools. This will be relatively quick. It basically boils down to, I think, having sort of dissected an enormous amount of literature into a total of two things. The potential for fracture healing and will the procedure allow for the weight-bearing needs of the patient? And we're going to go through a couple of scenarios here. So this is the first scenario, as you might see it in a chart at San Francisco General. So a 22-year-old male, MCA, motorcycle accident, PW, presents with a right Pipkin 2 femoral head fracture, which is this thing. Okay. So in this particular patient, does this patient have the potential for fracture healing? Absolutely. You know, 22-year-olds are like geckos. You can cut their tails off, and and they grow back. Okay. And then also, does this patient have significant weight-bearing needs? Not really. Most 22-year-old young men who are healthy enough to get into a motorcycle accident are healthy enough to use crutches. Okay, so I can do a procedure like this and fix the bone and say you got to stay on crutches for 3 months and let your hip heal. Okay, and that's a different scenario than this one. Now, the only thing I did in scenario two is I changed the age from 22 to 89, and I took away the motorcycle and I made it a GLF, which stands for ground level fall. Okay, but otherwise, it's exactly the same. Does this person have the potential for fracture healing? No, not really, actually. And if I fixed them, would they be able to tolerate being on crutches? Probably not. And in fact, they'd probably just be at a risk for falling down and having a problem with the other hip. And so instead, we can do this hemiarthroplasty that I was talking about. Now we don't need to worry about fracture healing. And now they are allowed to weight bear as tolerated. They can get up the next day out of bed and put as much weight as they want on that. Okay, so that's how we choose those two different procedures, even though superficially at first they look like the same problem. Another scenario, again, we have our 22-year-old male on a motorcycle, and now he's PWing with an inner troch anteric hip fracture. And again, that's a fracture that goes from the greater troch to the lesser troch. Okay, so same thing, great potential for healing. And does this person have significant weight-bearing needs? No, not really. And so we do this, and this is called a sliding hip screw. And then I again changed the scenario to an 89-year-old with a ground-level fall. And actually, as it turns out, there's a great potential for healing in an 89-year-old in this particular region of the femur. Which is why I spent all that time boring you about how the femoral head is different from the inner troch, which is different from the subtroch fracture. There's great potential for healing here. And so actually, in this case, I will do the same procedure as I would on a 22-year-old. Keep moving along. A 65-year-old male with a ground-level fall, he presents with a Garden 4 femoral neck fracture, and that means that the femoral head is nowhere close to the femoral neck anymore. Okay. And this is one of the more common injuries that we deal with. Now, in this 65-year-old, the potential, and actually in most people, not even just a 65-year-old, the potential for fracture healing is poor. And also, this person could probably stay off their hip if I asked them to. However, I have a solution that doesn't require them to, which is to do a hip replacement. So again, their potential for fracture healing was poor, so I don't want to do a procedure that requires fracture healing. I'm going to do something that requires no healing at all, which is an arthroplasty. So I remove the broken segment, and I put a pin down the femur and a ball and a cup in there. And in this 65-year-old person, this will get them back to golf. Basically, anything but running I would let them do after this procedure. And again, we changed this scenario just a little bit to an 89-year-old. Okay, so let's make this an 89-year-old demented nursing home patient. Okay, someone who is low demand and high risk for complications, namely dislocation. After you have a total hip replacement, there are certain positions for the rest of your life you can't put your hip in. And so someone with dementia is not going to be able to obey those restrictions. So we need to do something that's a little safer for them. And so in that case, I would do a hemiarthroplasty. And again, this is not something that I'd want to put in an active 65-year-old, but in an 89-year-old person who just needs to have a leg to stand on, this is the better, safer procedure. And then this is my 22-year-old acetabular patient. This is actually the real patient that I treated. So a 22-year-old on motorcycle with an associated both column acetabular fracture, which is just the worst acetabular fracture that we treat, as it turns out. This has a great potential for fracture healing. The patient, again, can be on crutches, so it doesn't have significant weight-bearing needs. And so I do a big six-hour surgery and fix them. And now, unfortunately, we'll do this to a 79-year-old with a ground-level fall, and this is actually becoming more and more common. Geriatric acetabular fractures used to be vanishingly rare. Now they're becoming much more common. It's actually the fastest-growing segment of acetabular fractures, or people over the age of 65. So potential for fracture healing, yes. Unfortunately, there's no procedure I can offer them that I'd let them be weight-bearing as tolerated. Okay, so I would do this big procedure, but they would be wheelchair-bound for 3 months. And this is just to make the point that me and no one else in orthopedics is a magician. Sometimes we have silver bullets and sometimes we don't. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about real quickly here are outcomes. So I mentioned at the beginning of the talk that, the first thing we're trying to do is reduce our mortality. And I would say there's no question that we reduce mortality by fixing the majority of these fractures. There is the occasional person that is too high risk to have a certain surgery, and we'll still treat them non-operatively. That's pretty rare. And then also the outcome of getting people out of bed and weight-bearing is tolerated. For most fractures, maybe 85% of the time, we can do that. And so those outcomes are good, but also under the category of outcomes is complications, okay? And there are a fair number of these, okay? So one complication we have to deal with more or less frequently, depending on which one of these fractures I was talking about specifically, is something called heterotopic ossification. So you can have someone who breaks their acetabulum, you can fix it with a bunch of plates and screws, and then as it turns out, there can be bone that bridges all the way from the pelvis to the femur and locks them in one position. Okay, and we have some ways to try to prevent this, but this still happens even in 2016, particularly if they've had head trauma. And again, this happens to a lesser or higher degree depending on the patient and depending on the injury. Avascular necrosis is another problem that we have to deal with, and that is a nice way of saying that the femoral head dies. So this is a normal femoral head. This is a femoral head that's in the process of dying. Okay, and this is a particular problem with femoral neck fractures. And again, even in 2016, we cannot prevent this all the time. Sciatic nerve palsy is more or less common with certain injuries and certain procedures. So the sciatic nerve does a lot of things in your leg. It does most of the functions in your leg. The one patients particularly miss the most is the ability to elevate their foot. You can imagine if you can't what we call dorsiflex your foot or lift your foot up when you walk, it's a nuisance. So you have a tendency to trip over this foot, particularly if it's insensate, because you can't feel anything either from your sciatic nerve palsy. And again, this happens in 1 to 25% of patients with these problems. Post-traumatic arthritis. So as it turns out, we can put all the bones back together in a perfect position, but we can't undo the injury. So if you have an injury that damages articular cartilage contemporarily, we still have very little to offer you. And so even if your x-rays look great, maybe at 6 months, 1 year, at 10 years, they may look like this. You may have a bunch of arthritis and plates and screws in the way. Non-union, which is a fancy term for saying they just didn't heal. There are some fractures that have a very low non-union rate. So the intertrochanteric fractures unite about 98% of the time. Not so with femoral neck fractures, which is what this is. In fact, these have a high rate of non-union, even in young, healthy people. We still usually try to fix them in young, healthy people because arthroplasties have a limited lifespan. And while if you get a total hip when you're 75, it may last you the rest of your life. The same is probably not true if you're 18. Dislocation. So this is why we don't always do total hips in everyone, and some people get a hemiarthroplasty. You can still dislocate a hemiarthroplasty. It's just less likely. And this is a real problem. Most people who dislocate don't become chronic dislocators, but there is a certain small segment of the population who have an unstable hip permanently, even after a well-done total hip. And then lastly, the one that keeps us up at night the most is infection. Infection is a huge problem in orthopedics because we put a bunch of implants in you that have no blood supply, have no immune system, and have no ability to get rid of an infection. So if you get an infection, often we will try to maintain your implants, but very frequently that does not work, and whatever you have in there eventually has to come out. And this is a huge problem, particularly in joint replacements, where we've taken out your joint. So if we take out your hip, and then the treatment for your infection is to take out your hip, you're left with no hip. Okay. Often we can put one back in after eradicating the infection, but not always. Okay. So these are the sort of things that keep orthopedists up at night worrying. And you know, there's a lot of comparisons to the field of aviation, and why aren't the results in medicine as good as, you know, landing a plane? And that's because I don't land planes for a living. You know, I treat patients, and patients are different. You know, I don't land the same 747 over and over and over with the same checklist every day. Medicine is much, much more complicated than that, and that's why we don't have the same results as aviation. It's just a harder problem to treat. So, just in summary, what's a hip fracture? It's a useless term. Okay, it's one that people still use, but it's not one that is particularly meaningful to an orthopedic surgeon. Why do we fix them? Number one, quality of life. It is a life-saving procedure. It's not often perceived that way, but it is. And the second thing is to improve the quality of life. How do we fix them? Well, we either do internal fixation. Again, that's implants that are designed to be temporary and work just long enough until your body heals and takes over. Or we decide it's at too high risk, it's not going to heal, and then we do an arthroplasty, where we take away your native anatomy and we put in an implant that has similar biomechanics. How do we choose amongst our tools? Potential for fracture healing and weight-bearing needs of the patient. And what are the outcomes? The outcomes are good, and they're better than being treated non-operatively, but there are still plenty of complications. And so what I'd recommend, which is what an orthopedic surgeon who was an elderly orthopedic surgeon who had fallen and broken his hip recommended to me as a medical student, which is don't fall. Okay. So that's all I have. Thank you very much. We have maybe 15 minutes or so for questions if anyone has something they want to ask. So that's a good question. There's a number of different materials that we use in orthopedics. So we use a lot of different types of metals. So we use titanium, we use stainless steel, and we use something called cobalt chrome. Those are probably the most common ones. And we use them because they have different material properties. So cobalt chrome is an incredibly hard metal. And because of that, we use it on a lot of bearing surfaces, meaning the ball of the femoral head is something usually made out of cobalt chrome because it's very wear resistant. As it turns out, if you stick a long rod of cobalt chrome down someone's femur, they don't like it because it's so stiff that it's actually stiffer than the bone that you're putting it into. And so it gives people thigh pain. And actually, it can be so stiff that it can prevent fracture healing. And so for a lot of things that we use to treat fractures, long bone fractures, we use titanium because titanium is a more malleable metal. And then stainless steel is usually what we use for plates, as it turns out. Has, again, the right... right compressive strengths and tensile strengths for fracture healing on bony surfaces. And then total hips is probably the place where we've had the largest improvement in some of our materials. So up until the year 2000, if you had a total hip, you got something called conventional polyethylene, which is the plastic part of the cup. And it was a good material, but it wears out, and it wears out at a measurable rate. After the year 2000, and we have something called highly cross-linked polyethylene, which is just a better version of it. And this seems to last significantly longer. And actually, it's a huge improvement in total hips because we're putting in more total hips in younger people that need to last longer. And so hopefully the ones we're putting in today are going to last a long time. But we can't tell you what the 30-year data is on total hips because we've only been doing them with this current material for 15. So we're still working on it is the long answer to the question.
So just to add to that, I think your point about the plastic surface, because again, the plastic liner in a knee replacement and in a hip replacement, it's kind of like the tire tread of the joint replacement. And with the older style plastics that were put in until about 2000 or 2002, roughly, they lasted roughly 10 years. So some would go a little bit longer, some wouldn't go quite as long. And since we started widespread use of that, it was actually used in Europe for a little while before that, this highly cross-linked polyethylene, the wear rates have gone down to such a small rate that we're really not even seeing any measurable changes at the 10 to roughly 15-year mark now for the early ones. So that is incredibly promising. And probably the one thing that I would say as far as this to you, there's a lot of interest in new and fancy and different and the greatest thing. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of bad press recently. So there's a lot of information about like the metal-on-metal hip that we heard about, and everyone thought this is going to be the home run, and it was put in the most active, youngest patients with the thought this would be a lifetime hip. And it turns out that really didn't work. So I would just say be wary of the absolute newest thing. I'm a huge fan of this highly cross-linked polyethylene because it's basically a technology that we use for about 40 years now. So we know what it does to the body. It's very reliable and predictable how it works, and we're getting great results with it that none of these ceramics or metal-on-metal or newer things can do. And so in some ways, we want a Ferrari. In some ways, we want a Honda Accord or Toyota Camry that's just going to start and go. And it's finding that real balance in it. And so just be careful with new and great and different, because if it doesn't have a proven track record, it may be the next big thing. But I think certainly for joint replacements, like the hip replacements that we're talking about tonight, that we do actually, I think, have a very good solution. So the question is, when we do a hip replacement or fix a hip, I'll add to that, is it difficult to judge the length and to set it right? So I'll let you answer that one.
Yeah, so the answer is you can get it right and you can get it wrong. And right now we're pretty good at getting it right. That said, there's competing goals. So there are times where I can get someone's leg lengths perfectly correct, but then their hip will be unstable and dislocate. So most people in that scenario, most rational people, would rather have their leg 5 millimeters too long and not dislocate. So it's a balance. So anyone who uses the appropriate implants and the appropriate templating software that helps us plan our surgeries can get leg length right or wrong. But sometimes getting a leg length wrong is actually the right thing.
One of the interesting things, too, is that the current state of the art, again, this is one of those things where the ideal is different than the reality. There's been a lot of interest recently in using computers, what they call these navigation systems, where we actually have cameras in the rooms and like little antennas on the pieces to try to get improve this and do better over time. And surprisingly, so far, whether it's in fractures or in joint replacements, using those systems, despite the huge learning curve and the technology and the expense of them, hasn't, and the time it takes in surgery to do them, hasn't made any significant difference. And the final point I would make towards that also is that there's a lot that goes into the limb length. And I have had patients that have come to me that have said their leg feels long or their leg feels short, and it's sometimes that is absolutely the case. As Paul was saying, you know, you're kind of measuring and getting the best fit during the surgery to make sure that it's stable and everything fits together and works together just as well. But sometimes, especially in a fracture situation, we click and put everything right back together like a jigsaw puzzle and it's perfect. And what can happen in that case is that you can get what's called a flexion contracture, or your hip gets bent. And sometimes with physical therapy or just the nature of the injury and damage to muscles and things like that, it doesn't straighten out all the way. And so it has that perception of being a little bit short. Now, regardless, you know, if your foot's short or your foot's long, it feels short or long, and it is one of those things we deal with. But certainly there's a lot of issues that go into it. Yeah. So the question is it important to follow bone density over time? And the answer is absolutely, for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, we know that every one of us is losing bone density over time. And probably just like other preventative tests, like getting a mammogram or men checking their PSA or getting a colonoscopy to make sure there's no polyps that lead to cancer, it's important to get these and then to follow it, because if you're okay at age 60, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be okay at age 80. And probably what's even more important is that if somebody has a bone density test that is very low, you want to really look at the effectiveness of treatment. As I mentioned, and one of the things I didn't get into in the talk is that as I went through the different medications that we commonly use, the ease of use, the ease of patients getting it, as well as the cost of it, goes up dramatically as I went through that list. And so it may be that you start with, you know, medication that's simple, like, you know, calcium and vitamin D, and then add a bisphosphonate, which is pretty inexpensive management that we can all get at Walgreens or CVS, and our primary doctors can prescribe it for us, no problem. That we want to make sure that works. And if it doesn't work, then we need to go to the next tier or the next treatment modality, or potentially look and see if there's something else that's going on that's a deeper medical problem than just time and use. So we do want to follow that over time and make sure that we're heading in the right direction and correcting those deficiencies. So the question is, can osteopenia, sort of pre-osteoporosis, be reversed back to more normal bone density? Yes, it can. It's not particularly easy, because all of these drugs kind of make a difference of a few percent. So the first and primary goal is to catch osteoporosis early and freeze it and kind of keep it at the level that it is. And then after that, some of these medications can improve sort of on the magnitude of about 3 to 5%, and it can make a big difference. So osteopenia, or pre-osteoporosis, that sort of in-between phase, that is a great time to catch it, because that 3% difference might bump back up into the normal range and really make a big protection down the road, especially if, say, this was diagnosed at a relatively younger age, 60 or 65, so that by the time we're maintaining that bone stock in your 70s or 80s, you're far, far better than later on.
Are you saying that you really should be on medication at that point?
I think it's variable, and I think it's beyond my management and beyond my scope. I think that's something that goes to a endocrinologist or a bone mineral specialist to talk about the pros and cons of that. As we mentioned, some of these medications definitely have some downsides. And risks that are associated with them. We found that out with the bisphosphonates over the last 10 years. There certainly is a lot of tolerance issues with it too. Personally, I feel that vitamin D and calcium are incredibly well-tolerated medications that practically everybody probably should be taking if they're not. And so I think those simpler, universal recommendations should be done. Getting into these bigger, more complex drugs that your body can't regulate so much and that do apparently have long-term implications, that's I think, a bigger decision. And oftentimes, it's people wait until you fall into the true osteoporosis category to start that level of treatment. Okay, so the question is, and we're doing this for the recordings as well as people in the room, to make sure you can hear, is if you fell, if you break your hip, do you know it effectively? Paul, you want to?
Yeah, so I'd say most of the time the answer is yes, it's pretty cut and dry. The majority of people who have a hip fracture, regardless of the ones that I mentioned, will not be able to get up and ambulate afterwards. And that's usually the reason actually they're brought in to see us. It's not because people see the leg and go, oh my goodness, it's a hip fracture. It's because they can't get up and walk. That said, there are occasions where you can have a hip fracture, rarely, and you can still ambulate. So, for example, there are actually a large number of pelvis fractures where that's still possible, where the pelvis still has enough stability that you get up and walk, but on an x-ray you might still have a fracture. And there are also some fractures of small pieces of the bone, like the greater trochanter can fracture off. And all that does is it causes a muscle attachment to no longer be attached. So you can still ambulate for that, but it would be painful. But the majority of hip fractures that we're talking about in either of these lectures are the sort of thing that you would fall and not be able to get up and have to be taken to the hospital for evaluation.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, is there a suitable treatment for osteoarthritis of the hip?
Oh.
Yeah, so the question is there surgical treatment for osteoarthritis? And the answer is yes, and that's a hip replacement. So osteoarthritis is basically... In simplest terms, it's the breakdown of the cartilage surfaces of a joint. And so that affects definitionally both sides of the joint, both the femoral head and the acetabulum. And so we do, in that case, a total hip replacement where we resurface both sides of the joint. That's actually the primary reason we do hip replacements. I did two of them today, was for osteoarthritis of the hip, not for hip fractures. And the same is true for the knee. Most knee replacements are done for knee osteoarthritis, not for fracture, although we do occasionally do that. Dr. Meinberg showed a case. So the question is sort of what are the activities you can do after a hip replacement? So you have friends that play golf or play tennis, and are they doing that, or are they doing that against doctor's orders? And I would say, no, that's fantastic. That's the reason we normally do hip and knee replacements. If we did a hip replacement and you said, okay, you have a great hip replacement, but you have to sit on the couch now, then no one would want it, and we wouldn't want it for you either. So, you know, the goal of most hip replacements for arthritis is to get you back to the activities that you want to do. Now, you can't go bungee jumping, you can't go skydiving, and I don't let people run. I tell them that they shouldn't run because it's the treads on the tire analogy. So if you put 26 miles on your hip every day for 10 years, even with modern plastics, it's probably going to wear out. But other than that, I don't restrict people.
The other thought with that, too, is actually just shock absorption within the joint. And so if you're doing things where you are really bouncing around, so running is the other thing, where you just... That plastic is actually separating, and the metal, the super hard chrome ball is just beating into the plastic repeatedly. The thought is that would greatly accelerate it. Whereas things like tennis, especially doubles tennis, hiking, swimming, biking, skiing, things like that, where it's a much more fluid motion, you can do that. There's these simulators where they actually will take joint replacements and they'll just move them in fluid for millions of cycles, and that's where it's really not showing very much wear. But it says more high impact things that are just, the concern is that it really, really beats it up much, much faster. I think we have time for one more question. So, in the back. So the question is, how important is exercise in maintaining healthy bones? And there is tremendous research that says that's incredibly important. So again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, our bones are living, dynamic structures, and it truly is use it or lose it. And so bearing weight, and we do this after fractures and a number of things, actually increases the amount of bone that you have. And so not only does it actually physically increase the bone stock, the increased muscle strength and coordination in that too prevents the risks of falls, because you just have much, much better strength and muscle control and endurance to prevent those things from happening. So it truly is a case of use it or lose it. So we are finished with the official bright light portion of this presentation. So if anybody has any last minute questions, you certainly can come up here afterwards. We can talk about them informally. But thank you very much for coming this evening. We really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.